This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at how the states are removing a woman's right to choose an abortion.
Animus against women, even hatred against women, has been a hallmark of right-wing regimes from the beginning, and we're seeing that develop in the United States now.
We explore U.S. aggression toward Cuba and what it means for the people living there.
As bad as it has been, although it was slightly relieved under the Obama administration, the Trump administration is really turning the screws and trying to cause misery, further misery, to the Cuban people.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In 1973, in the famous Roe v. Wade case, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a woman's right to obtain an abortion was protected under the U.S. Constitution. The core holding in Roe, which remains the law today, is that the government may not prohibit a woman from obtaining an abortion prior to fetal viability and may do so after viability as long as abortion may be available to protect a woman's life and health. A woman's right to make childbearing decisions is an essential part of women's overall equality. Recent legislation in Ohio bans abortion as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy, before many women even know they're pregnant. Kentucky and Mississippi have similar laws, and 10 other states are currently considering them. Will the Supreme Court take the Ohio case as an opportunity and use it to overturn the 45-year-old Roe v. Wade decision? We speak today with Elizabeth Watson, an attorney with the ACLU, and with Vicki Breitbart, a retired Sarah Lawrence professor specializing in women's reproductive health. For over 40 years, Vicki Breitbart has worked as an educator, researcher, and activist dedicated to sexual and reproductive justice. Presently, she's associate professor at NYU's Silver School of Social Work. Lizzie Watson is a staff attorney at the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project at the National Office in New York. She litigates cases to defend the right to abortion and contraception for all people, regardless of race, ethnicity, economic status, gender identity, or geographic location. Lizzie and Vicki, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Last month, the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, signed legislation banning abortion as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy. Ohio then became the third state this year to enact this type of ban, along with Kentucky and Mississippi. Georgia is about to get the ban. Some 10 other states, including Texas, Missouri, and Alabama, are also considering it. Much of this action today focuses on state laws, correct?
Yeah, I'd like to put this in context, because what I didn't really see coming was the importance, for instance, of federal judges that were appointed early on in the Trump administration, because this is really all preparing for these to go to the Supreme Court now that they know it's a more conservative court. So these laws are going to be passed one after another and go up through the gauntlet of judicial review until something is really brought up to the Supreme Court. I think this is well prepared. This is exactly the strategy. And some of them we know have been cut down, and some of them are under injunction, but we're going to see one after another, and there are various strategies going on.
Yeah, so I think you're totally right that most of this is going on in the states, for better or for worse. But you're right, we're going in front of federal judges and more Trump appointees. I mean, getting Trump in the White House so that he could nominate the judges that he wants, like, makes it hard to be in federal court and can make it hard to be in state court as well. That's why voting is so important. But yeah, there are definitely certain states, and Ohio is one of them, where it is already incredibly difficult to obtain an abortion. And now, of course, they're going to limit in 6 weeks, so it's going to be impossible to obtain an abortion there. And right, they're not the only state, and unfortunately, but expectedly, it's the most hostile states that are still trying to push it just further and further.
Is this ban constitutional?
Well, I certainly have to defer. I don't know if we can decide that here.
Not based on current precedent, right? No. right? Because we have Roe, we have Casey, and, you know, Governor DeWine has said, like, they're trying to overturn Roe. The person who wrote that bill in Ohio is trying to overturn. So they don't think that under current precedent that they have the ability to do this, but they want to, like, as Vicky said, bring a challenge to the Supreme Court. They're looking to change the law, but I think we all know that the law currently right now is that's not what precedent says.
What about the change in the personnel of the Supreme Court? How does it matter now? How does that compare today to when Roe was first decided a half century ago?
Well, I mean, the law we have now, we've had for a while, right? So we've had Roe v. Wade for, you know, since the 70s. And Casey, you know, is still more than, you know, four decades old. So if with governing precedent, it shouldn't matter who's on the court.
Can you talk just briefly about Casey for listeners who may not know?
Sure. Casey was a case in the 1990s where I think it was out of Philadelphia and it involved a few different restrictions, including a waiting period. And a spousal notification provision. And what the Supreme Court ultimately held and why it kind of changed the landscape for abortion restrictions was that instead of having the trimester framework that Roe had, it ended up saying that as long as you don't have an undue burden on the right to obtain an abortion, that you can that a state can pass abortion restrictions. And ever since then, and especially in this climate, states have been passing additional abortion restrictions, trying to test that out. Like, what is an undue burden? Trying to move the line, right? And we're trying to hold the line. And this precedent was recently upheld in Whole Woman's Health in 2016, where they said an undue burden is when the burdens of a law outweigh the benefits, right? So we, as it stands now, we have a lot of law supporting our side and not having these restrictions go into effect. I think we're right now we are in a good place as far as the law goes in defeating these bans, but
Women's ability to obtain abortions has been chipped away ever since Roe in other ways besides these most heinous legislation. I mean, there are all kinds of things that have passed in terms of what's required for women to go through before they can get an abortion. And all of this has already happened, and all of this is still standing, even regardless of Roe.
Vicky, give us an example or two, if you can.
Well, some of the restrictions have to do with age. Minors still are restricted in many states without parental consent, and even though there is a way to go to bypass that, it still exists in many states. There's 24-hour waiting periods, so women who have to now travel long distances have to go back one or two times. There is also restrictions. There's laws that say things that you have to give counseling about certain things that actually are not even true, that abortions cause breast cancer, for instance. So one after another, these have sort of been put in our place to restrict access. And this is a long line of restrictions that have already been accomplished.
Let's talk about the common abortion restrictions that women face. What about method bans? What procedures are outlawed?
So thus far we have been, there have been many states that tried to outlaw the most common and safest second trimester abortion procedure. But so far, no state where a doctor's actually practicing abortion, because in some states just don't practice second trimester abortions. There's just no doctor in the state that practices it. So in a couple of states, West Virginia is one of them, and the other one is eluding me right now. They have the bans in effect, but it didn't actually stop any practice. There was no ability to get a second trimester abortion there anyway. And every state where there was a second trimester abortion where they have tried to ban the procedure and essentially ban second trimester abortions, because if you can't do the procedure, then you can't do the abortions at all. Those laws have been struck down by the courts.
What about mandatory delay requirements and biased counseling laws?
Some states have 24 hours. Some states have 48 hours. One state has 72 hours. So figuring out what the burden is, right? Like, that goes back to, like, the undue burden. And certainly, I think it is fair to say the restrictions that we have now, some of those burdens many people would say are undue, but the court has upheld them. So those are the kind of restrictions that we're dealing with. Like we were saying at the beginning, it's already so tough to get care in so many places because of these restrictions.
I just want to go back a minute because there is one form of abortion in second trimester that has been banned under the Carhart decision.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right.
And I think that set a precedent of overruling what a doctor chooses is the best and safest procedure to use. And the court decided that you couldn't do that, even over a doctor's decision to do this. So it's another form of second trimester abortion that now is totally forbidden.
Thanks, Vicki. Speaking about the doctor side of this, what are trap laws and the requirements put on doctors who provide abortions?
The trap laws basically were proposed in quote for women's health. It actually is the safest procedure. Abortions are the safest procedure, and TRAP stands for
a targeted regulation of abortion providers.
Right. So basically what it is a series of regulations that make it very difficult to have abortions in a clinical setting. Some of the requirements are way more stringent than even in a hospital, and thereby really trying to eliminate certain clinics altogether.
And meaning the clinics have to have certain facilities, certain equipment.
Right. The hallways have to be a certain distance to let the gurneys go back and forth, which is absolutely not what happens in abortion clinics. But this was all for under the guise of protecting women's health.
Can low-income women get federal funds for abortion now?
No. Ever since the Hyde Amendment, it's that 1977, I think.
Shortly after Roe.
Yes, right. Exactly. Congress basically passed that no federal funds could be used for abortions. And that's been standing for all these years.
And many states eliminate the possibility to obtain state funds for abortion as well. So under current law, there's no federal funds for abortion ever for anyone. But if your Medicaid is funded by the states and the federal government, so if the state wants to put in their Medicaid program that they will cover abortions, they can't do that. Not a lot of states have done that. But actually, there is some progress. Illinois recently was looking at their ban, and I know we have a few lawsuits. The ACLU has a few lawsuits trying to get states to drop their Medicaid ban because it's such an essential, like not being able to afford this procedure is a real barrier. Right.
I think there are 17 states now that provide abortions, that pay for abortions for women on Medicaid with state funds.
And what about private insurance providers? Do they cover it?
Yeah, I think some states do prohibit it, but I'm not totally sure. I think one of the difficulties is like figuring it out. I mean, the sad thing is that abortion care is not considered medical care, right? So there is definitely no guarantee that like your provider will cover it. I think a lot of states or a lot of providers are telling us, right, that because it's so expensive at the hospital and many insurances that do cover it only cover it in limited circumstances. So even hospitals are relying on the clinics and saying like, you should go to the clinic because ultimately, if we can't get coverage, and we think we probably can't, this will be, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars for you here at the hospital. So hospitals rely on the clinics as well, right? And it helps the hospitals to not have to get into the controversy, right? To just say, just go to the clinic. So they're relying on the clinics, but at the same time, like politicians are.
Have abortion services been eliminated in public hospitals?
In many public hospitals, yes. Yeah, it's the same, right, that hospitals are relying on the clinics. I mean, I don't think they like it, but that they're like, well, there's a clinic that you can go to, right? There's another place. So hospitals are counting on clinics to stand in and provide the services when they can't.
What's the situation in New York City, which has a public hospital infrastructure?
They do provide.
Yeah, as far as I know, you can go to any public hospital here and get an abortion.
Which is good because many people need to be in a hospital, right? Like there are medical mm-hmm. conditions where it is safer to be in a hospital, right? And what you would ultimately want is for people to have the safest care. For many people, that is a clinic. Probably for most people, that's available at a clinic. But some people just need, you know, people with disabilities, especially, right, need the hospital care.
The fetal person issue seems to be gaining some traction. What is that?
So it's this idea that fetuses have the same rights as you or me, right? I think the concept is very, like, easy to understand, right? It's like, oh, like a fetus, like from fertilization or an embryo has the same rights as you and me, the right not to be assaulted, right? Not to be murdered. Like, that's the idea. I think in practice it's very confusing. Like, what does it mean to be a person living inside of another person? Obviously, that's going to have very serious implications for pregnant people and for the law. The law is not set up that way currently. So even though the rhetoric of, like, we're going to treat a fetus as a person or an embryo as a person has some rhetorical value to people that support that position, I think in reality how it would work, I can't imagine how it would work out in reality.
Last week, Judge Baskin in Washington State halted Trump's gag rule. What did the gag rule do about limiting what a doctor could say to her patient?
As far as I understood it, the gag rule doesn't allow for doctors to talk about or refer for abortion, or if they're accepting Title X money, which is basically money for gynecological care, that they can't do the abortions in the same facility that they provide family planning and contraceptive and other services. So it means that you have to totally separate these services if you want to continue to receive any federal funding for contraception.
There are scary things happening around the country. For instance, Georgia now has a law allowing for a criminal investigation subsequent to a woman's miscarriage. And in other places, the death penalty has been put forward to be used against women who get abortions. And just last Saturday, Trump gave a speech in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where he talked about a woman getting an abortion in a hospital and deciding not to, and the baby is born, and wrapped, Trump said, in a beautiful blanket. It's a beautiful baby. And then the doctor and the woman decide whether to execute the baby. That's a quote, execute. Plenty scary things happening, don't you agree?
Yeah, I think that fear is being used really to excite people to support the anti-abortion movement. And I think the reality itself is very frightening. I just want to place it in context, too, because there were instances where women were imprisoned for using drugs during pregnancy. And I think we have to put that in perspective now. Basically, again, it was trumping the fetus's rights over the woman's rights. Now, I understand that using drugs is not just about having an abortion, but it does set a precedent for basically these new laws, which trump women's rights—excuse the pun—trump women's rights in favor of the fetus.
In terms of the anti-abortion movement, talk about who makes up this constituency.
I think it's hard to know. Exhale, which is a group in California that does post-abortion counseling on the phone, actually decided to have women go from state to state to talk to people who were really anti-abortion, to really try to appeal to people about their own stories and what's the reality out there. And I think that's the thing that we've really not taken into account, the reality of women's lives. It's and really talked about the emotions that are behind this. So this cadre that went from state to state really told their own stories. And I think they found a lot of response of people. The National Network of Abortion Funds has a saying that everybody loves someone who's had an abortion, because actually one out of every four women in this country has had an abortion before the age of 45. So there are a lot of people out there who I think are really being missed in terms of just having these conversations. And so when the anti-abortions of the people who are anti-abortion are basically out there rallying people, that's what people hear. And we really need to tell the real story of what's going on.
What's happening with Planned Parenthood? Are they still under attack?
Oh, I think certainly. Right. Very fortunately, as you were mentioning earlier, they won the case against the gag rule because a lot of Title X is Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood provides a lot of services besides abortion, right? So being able to eliminate Planned Parenthood from that program seemed like a goal of the Trump administration, right? And I think they're very visible, right? So I think they are certainly under some pressure, right? And states as well are trying to eliminate them from their family planning programs. And it's terrible because they are providing a lot of the services, a lot of needed services in a lot of rural places, a lot of places that wouldn't have access to contraceptive care now. Like, we're not even talking about abortion. They do provide abortion, but that's a small part of what they do. But when you exclude Planned Parenthood from any public funding, you are really talking about access to women's contraception.
I think that this relates to the stigma against abortion, because Planned Parenthood has been associated with abortion. And the reality is, and I worked there for many, many years, the reality is that that's a smaller percentage of actually what Planned Parenthood does. And so it's really disguised attacks on women in general and women's reproduction in general and women's autonomy in general when they pick on just the abortion piece that Planned Parenthood does.
On a personal note, if I might, could each of you tell us what it was that got you involved in defending a woman's right to choose?
For me, actually, it started many, many years ago around the issue of daycare. I actually was a teacher and worked in Head Start and realized that the inability for women to work and make decisions about working had to do with the lack of childcare and how that was controlled also by the federal government, what was available and what was not available. And it really divided women by class in terms of who could afford it. So I started with opening up childcare centers and working with educators and realized that at the heart of it, it really was about women's autonomy. And then realized how much our bodily integrity was really involved and in the issue of abortion and the issue of contraception, and that it was all, for me, one package of attacks on women and women's control.
Lizzie?
So I am a black woman, and I think that a lot of the history of this nation is about controlling the reproductive capacities of people of color. And I think now when you look at the statistics of who's getting abortions, it is largely populations of color. So when you're restricting abortion and making it more difficult to get, the lives you're really affecting are disproportionately people of color. And I wanted to be a lawyer for a long time, and I wanted to work on behalf of my community. And I really feel that my community is black women especially and women of color. So I saw an opportunity to work on behalf of my community when I got the opportunity to go work at the ACLU and do this work and defend these rights for people in my community and for women in my community especially.
Well, what do we need to do to retain abortion rights?
One thing that's very heartening is that women's groups that have been working on this for a long time and a diverse group of women's groups have all come together to really try to strategize in a unified way. I think that the siloing of what has been a women's movement by race, by religion, has really been a detriment to what we can achieve. So I think that's something that's really changed and that's really important, that 50 groups working on these issues have come together in Washington to put together a blueprint or a strategy, an overall strategy, to tie it together. Then I think there is the work of individual organizations that's really very important, from women who are helping to defend clinics, organizations that do that, to one group I'm working with, the Doula Project, which is actually providing doulas for abortions. So on a very personal level, then there's also the National Network of Abortion Funds, mentioned earlier, which is just raising money for women who have to travel long distances. So I think there are a variety of different organizations and a variety of different things that women can do in individual states and overall nationally.
What was done a half a century ago to win the right for women to control their own bodies? What did we do then, and can we replicate that now?
One of the things that really happened in the early 60s were called speak outs, where women talked about their experiences and exposed the dangers that women really had to, that they were experiencing because it wasn't legal. And women talked about those experiences in very, very vivid ways. And that's happening again. Women are starting to tell stories again. And I think that was very important in terms of changing the attitude of people towards abortion. Also, I think that physicians became part of the equation. And physicians who had already been trying to move in the direction of abortion as a women's health issue joined this, so that when masses of women and physicians really helped to turn the tide, I think, nationally.
You were speaking before about Trump's quite expert use of fear. And that's what the abortion opponents do. They say abortion is murder. How do you react to that kind of thought process?
One of the things in my own family, I have found that when people talk about this, it's a very emotional issue. And yet the meeting ground is whether it should be legislated. I think that how you feel about it for yourself is very different than how you want to legislate it for all women and how you want to impose this on all women's right to choose. And I think that's where I've really had a conversation. However you believe is one aspect of it, but to turn it into legislation and to turn it into ways to control what all women do, I think is really the problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of rhetoric going around, and you were asking, like, what can people do? I think be a little bit more informed, because I think there is some backsliding. Like, we're not where we were in the 70s, but I was talking to a friend was telling me about a supporter of abortion rights the other day saying, like, well, I think that she should be able to get an abortion if she wants to, but I also think she should wait a day, right? And that's somebody who considers themselves an abortion rights supporter, right? Saying that it's normal to want to have somebody have to wait a day, like a 24-hour waiting period. And I think that comes from that being so ubiquitous, right? That you would now think like, oh, it's okay to tell a woman you're not ready to make up your mind yet. You need another day. But I'm not saying you can't get one. So I'm still a supporter. And I believe that person was a supporter, but it's just like evidence of the backsliding that we've had. So I think really understanding and thinking about these issues. So when you hear Trump's rhetoric or a conservative politician's rhetoric or a family member's confusion about what's going on, that you can actually set them straight and say, you know, even if you haven't had the procedure yourself, say, actually, you know, I think that women are probably capable of making a decision on what to do with their bodies without waiting 24 hours. Or if they want to wait, then they know that they can wait. And there's no reason, like Vicky was saying, to legislate those sort of things.
I just wanted to add that I've been meeting with a small group of women trying to put together e-blasts about what the reality is, rather than what just the rhetoric is. Because I think you're absolutely right, Lizzie. The more information people have about this really helps. I think it's a combination of realizing the stories and how it affects women's lives, and also the actual reality of what's happening there. The fact that women were having abortions way before Roe, and that legislation is not going to ever stop women from having abortions or wanting to have abortions. It's just how they do it and whether it's available to all people to make that choice.
We just have a couple of minutes remaining. On this issue of women were always getting abortions, if Roe is overturned, do you anticipate a black market for abortions? And or will that be more difficult than it was, say, in the 50s?
So I think if people are unable to obtain the care that they need, much like people when they're unable to obtain the care they need right now because of state restrictions, certainly women try things on their own, right, without medical advice, right? And some of those people end up in the emergency room. And that was certainly more prevalent before before Roe. But yeah, I think that will happen, right? And people will try to travel to more friendly states, but that's just not going to be a reality for everyone. That's not going to be a possibility for everyone, especially when you look at the way the states are laid out, right? Like if there's no abortion available in all of the Southeast United States, right? Some people just aren't going to be able to come to New York, right? That's a big trip. So what that means for women's health and women's safety, like it's very scary.
Yeah, I think it's very dangerous. I just want to add, though, that with the rise of medication abortion, that you also won't have to necessarily travel from states or go to states where this is happening. We're trying to prepare for the reality that women will need to obtain safe abortions, even when it's not legal.
What's a medication abortion?
Their medication abortion is something that was introduced around 2000, which is basically medication that's used to both stop the pregnancy and then to expel the pregnancy. And you take one medication, and then you can actually take the other medication to expel the pregnancy at your home. So it's all done through medication and counseling. It's important to have counseling with it to understand what happens when the medications take effect. But it doesn't mean you have to be in a clinic anymore to actually get an abortion,
but of course,
up to a certain amount of weeks.
But there's a risk, isn't it, that the law might outlaw that as well?
Like a 6-week ban on abortion would affect medication abortion as well.
I think it depends on how this happens and, you know, and what the specifics are.
Right. There are cases, like the ACLU has a case now trying to reduce some of the restrictions that are on medication abortion. Like right now, there are a lot of federal restrictions, FDA restrictions on who can carry medication abortion, who can prescribe medication abortion. That makes it harder for you can't have it at the pharmacy. You have to get it directly from the doctor. That make it harder to obtain it. And most doctors have to get permission doctors at a hospital have to get permission from their hospital to do it, which then creates like the public relations aspect of it. So there's some limitations on it now that we are trying to get rid of to make it more accessible, because right now there are some limitations that I think make it not as widely available as it could be.
Well, that's a lot of what we're doing in preparation for this if it should happen, because I think also having it not only available in clinics but in family physician offices is one of the moves also that some of us are trying to see happen.
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time. If our listeners want to learn more, can you suggest a couple of resources online?
Well, I know some of the organizations doing really good journalism on this are Rewire. I think if you're interested in the kind of finding out more about the advocacy, the ACLU has a blog. And you were mentioning earlier, like the criminalization of pregnancy, and National Advocates for Pregnant Women does a lot of work on that aspect. And I think it's a really interesting point of the law and happening in places that you wouldn't expect. So checking out their website and the work they do, I think, is also really informative.
Any last thoughts before we have to say goodbye, Vicki or Lizzie?
Well, I'd just like to put in somewhat of an optimistic note, because I think we've talked so much about the restrictions and how much is happening to us. But I think there's a lot of activity now, and a lot of organizations are being very proactive in trying to prepare for what will happen. And I think we should feel somewhat positive even about some of the restrictions that have not been able to make it to the Supreme Court.
Lizzie, any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I just thank you for giving me this opportunity. Like I said, I think it's really important that people be informed about what's really going on. So I appreciate you guys taking the time on your show to put this information out there.
Well, yes, thank you.
Attorney Lizzie Watson and retired Professor Vicki Breitbart, Heidi and I really appreciate your coming into the studio and talking with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
United States of America has ratcheted up its ongoing 60-year effort to overthrow the elected government of Cuba and restore an American-dominated corporate capitalism to the island. This effort was relaxed a bit under the Obama administration. That all has changed. Dollar remittances from Cubans living in the USA to their relatives in Cuba have been drastically cut. Travel to Cuba by Americans, which has been considerable, has been virtually banned. The Helms-Burton Law, which was meant to strangle the Cuban economy, was never fully enforced until just now. Under the guidance of the ultra-right-wing Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton, a 23-year-old dormant aspect of the Helms-Burton Law has been invoked. It now allows Cubans who live in America to sue the government of Cuba in American courts to get back their estates, mansions, businesses, and property holdings, which were legally nationalized after the 1959 Cuban Revolution. This new aggression is meant to cause such severe hardship to the Cuban people that they will be willing to allow their government to be overthrown. We speak today with Walter Lippmann, the editor of the online blog Cuba News. Lippmann has just returned from Cuba, where he travels frequently.
Walter Lippmann, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Good morning to you.
Before Trump's election, what was the United States doing to damage Cuba?
Well, just about everything that it could except shooting. Actually, the current legislation, the Helms-Burton Law, which was passed in 1996, what it basically did was it made federal law out of all of the previous federal government policies. So in order to change policy, you also have to change federal law. So that would make it much harder for an administration to make a change toward a more normalized relationship with Cuba, because you also would have to get it passed by both houses of the Congress, since it's now a federal law. They have been doing many things to try to basically to sabotage the Cuban economy, to prevent Cuba from engaging in normal commercial transactions with other countries. For example, the most obvious example is that Cuba, when it purchases food from the United States, is required to pay for that food in advance of delivery. So it's like, you imagine, you go into a bar and you ask for the bartender for a drink, and the bartender says, pay first before we pour the drink into your glass. So that's only one example. Under the Helms-Burton Law, the United States devised an entire series of demands that the Cuban government would have to agree to in order to have normal relations with the United States. One of those requirements is that nobody named Castro could be the head of the government, which nobody named Castro is the head of the government today, for example. And secondly, under the Helms-Burton Law, it required as a condition of normal relations with Cuba that all previous legal demands by people who had lost their property under the revolution would have to be paid off before there could be any normal relations with Cuba. So no other country in the world has ever faced this in the entire history of American foreign policy.
So what have been the effects respecting the growth of a healthy Cuban economy?
Well, the main effect is that it is much harder and much more expensive, A, for Cuba to obtain commodities as well as services from the United States. You know, there are some American companies that actually do business in Cuba today legally. For example, the management of various hotels, several of the hotels. I don't know how the latest changes will affect that, because an announcement was made by the Treasury Department, OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, just yesterday, that a whole new series of changes in law will be announced, but they have not yet been announced. They're calling for public discussion. So, but they have not actually announced what the specific changes will be, other than increasing reporting requirements for the various companies that provide provide travel to Cuba.
Walter, you've recently returned to Cuba, and you travel there a lot. What did you observe about the lot of the average Cuban? How do they get by?
Well, they get by on a combination of two things. Some get by on, very minimally, get by on Cuban salaries. But remember, of course, in Cuba, nobody pays anything for health care or education. But many Cubans also have second jobs or operate in the informal sector in one way or another to try to get the make ends meet.
Why has the United States been so hostile to Cuba? It tried to stop the overthrow of dictator Batista even prior to the revolution, didn't it? What have the Cubans done wrong to us?
Well, the number one thing that Cuba does wrong, as far as the United States is concerned, is to be an independent country, simply with a right, simply with the power to be whatever it wants to be and to create whatever kinds of social and political institutions it wishes to create for itself. That's the most important thing. Cuba's independence, more than any other thing, that's the thing that the United States rejects. You know, throughout American history, in fact, just recently, President Trump and John Bolton have announced that the Monroe Doctrine is back. Remember, the Monroe Doctrine is almost 200 years old, in which the United States declared that Latin America should basically be under the control of the United States, and that's what the Monroe Doctrine says. And that is what has been repeated most recently, even in recent days, by Bolton and Trump.
I think also, had the United States not stunted the development of the Cuban economy for the last 60 years, and had the Cubans been able to develop a robust economy and a place where people were really well off, I think that kind of an example of a country developing outside of capitalist property relations was a threat to Cuba. Don't you agree? It was a threat to the United States.
Well, the independence is a threat to the United States. You know, before 1959, Cuba was granted, and it had been since the 1930s, had been permitted to sell a great deal of its sugar to the United States. This is what Eisenhower ended in 1960. So Cuba has always wanted to have normal trading and normal business relations with the United States, and that is what the United States does not allow, because Cuba chooses to organize its social and political life in its own way, not as required by Washington.
Walter, recently John Bolton addressed veterans of the CIA in Miami. What did he say about the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1960?
Actually, I have not found a transcript of what he said, so I can't answer that.
There are over 1.5 million Cubans who left their country and now live in Florida. They were given American citizenship. Do they support the new measures against the people on the island?
Some do, some don't. Those who lost property don't. Most of those who lost property, support these new measures, but many don't. I know Cubans personally who live in Miami because they didn't want to live in Cuba, hoping to have a better material life in Miami. But they travel back and forth to Cuba all the time. They're not what we call exiles because they go back. One of my friends is going back for Mother's Day. This will be, I think, her fifth or sixth visit to Cuba since she left in November of 2016.
Are the travel restrictions that apply, do those apply to people who have family in Cuba, or do those apply to Americans generally? Because I know that Trump has clamped down on people freely being able to travel to Cuba.
We are waiting for the new regulations to be issued by the Treasury Department. The indication is, from yesterday's OFAC announcement, is that there will be much more comprehensive reporting requirements for the travel agencies that organize flights and travel to Cuba. But we have not seen details yet, so it's hard to comment.
Walter, let's talk now about the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela and the U.S. policy toward Venezuela, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cuba has been Cuba has had a very close relationship with Venezuela since the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution. In fact, one of his very first trips outside of Cuba after the triumph in 1959 was precisely to Venezuela. Now, under Chavez, Cuba has begun to provide a tremendous amount of aid to Venezuela, not material aid so much as medical and training support for and educational support to the various social programs that exist in Cuba, such as medical care for people who had never seen doctors before. Cuba provides a tremendous amount of that, in exchange for which Venezuela provides things like oil, and Venezuela also helps Cuba build houses. They've actually built houses made out of oil production byproducts. They call them petrocasas. I've seen them. In fact, I remember about 4 years ago I went to Santiago de Cuba when there had been a giant hurricane, and many, many houses were destroyed in that hurricane, except the petrocasas in Santiago, which all survived the hurricane without difficulty. So they have a very close political and diplomatic relationship, and they have had ever since Hugo Chavez came in 1998.
John Bolton has called Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela the troika of tyranny. It recalled to my mind when George Bush spoke about Iraq and Iran as the axis of evil. And then Bush went on and committed the supreme crime, a war of aggression against Iraq, where about 1 million people were killed. Perhaps that many were displaced as refugees. Now, with the ramping up of aggression against Cuba, at least economic aggression at this point, what do you think Bolton and the Trump administration have in mind? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, they're trying to reverse the independence that Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua have been able to obtain since their revolutions overthrew previous U.S.-backed dictators. That's the main purpose.
What do you think of the failed coup of last week against the elected Maduro government in Venezuela?
Well, this coup was begun yesterday and has seemed to have failed from all indications. In fact, the leaders of the opposition that called for a mobilization to overthrow the government just yesterday in Venezuela, they've gone into exile. They're in embassies. Leopoldo Lopez is in the Spanish embassy, and Guaido, I forget which embassy he's in, and 25 of the soldiers that broke with the government have all gone into the Brazilian embassy seeking asylum. And, you know, there's been a great deal of struggle over and resentment and opposition to the restrictions that the United States has put on people's right to travel to Cuba. But I don't know, has anybody ever thought of fighting this on the basis of discrimination? Since what's actually happened is under all these regulations, Cubans who have family in the United States are allowed to freely travel to the country, are allowed to freely travel there when the rest of us are not allowed to do that unless we fit into certain narrowly prescribed legal parameters. I go as a journalist. In fact, when I'm in Cuba, I send reports every single day. But to me, it seems like there's an issue of racial discrimination. In fact, discrimination, however, in favor of one group and against all the rest who don't have a right to travel to Cuba automatically.
You're saying there's a difference between the right of Cubans who live in the United States to go back to the island as opposed to Americans who are not Cubans. What's the discrimination?
The discrimination is that Cubans are allowed to travel to and from Cuba. Cubans who live in the United States are allowed to travel to and from Cuba without asking permission of the United States government or saying that they fit into a legal category, whereas the rest of us are required to meet certain legal requirements in order to have the right to travel. Does that make sense? It's discrimination in favor of one privileged minority group that has special rights, special privileges, and special advantages that all the rest of us don't have.
Well, I think as a policy issue, and I want to get Heidi's opinion on this, but I think it's a policy issue. The United States was trying to cater to these Cubans, many of whom were a base for the Republican Party.
You know, we're having a presidential election next year, and Florida is a very important state.
I think the argument would fail because the United States would say it's a matter of national security.
That people should be able to go back to Cuba for Mother's Day without asking permission.
I would say, even though in 2015 the U.S. removed Cuba from the official terror list, still, with its hostility towards Cuba, I believe the government would bring out some argument like that. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
It hasn't been, as far as I know, the issue hasn't been raised. So I wish somebody would raise it.
Walter, you've been a supporter of the Cuban Revolution really since the very beginning when you were a young man. What was it that got you interested in what was going on in Cuba and kept your interest?
Well, you and I would not be having this conversation today if it were not for Cuba. Let me explain. In 1938, my father and his parents were German-Jewish exiles who were forced to leave Nazi Germany. They wanted to come to the United States, but the United States had a quota limiting the number of Jews who could enter the country. So they were refused permission to enter the United States in 1938, and they went to Cuba, where they waited for 3 years to obtain permission to come to the United States. So I wouldn't have been born if it hadn't been for Cuba. So I feel that I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude toward Cuba for taking my father and his parents in. He met my mother in the United States. I was born and conceived here.
Walter, I too would not be here except for Cuba, because my Armenian grandmother fled the Armenian genocide as a teenager and had to stay in Cuba for a long period before they let her into the U.S. because she had an eye they thought was infected.
Uh-huh.
So we both thank Cuba.
Well, you know, Cuba, there was a good deal of support for the Armenian people in Cuba in the aftermath of the genocide.
I believe it.
I did a little research about that just recently, and there was a substantial amount of support for Armenia at that time. I still don't know exactly what Cuba's relationship with Armenia is today.
Me neither.
But I think it's a friendly and normal one, but
I'm sure.
I actually don't know.
Yeah.
Walter, let's talk about Cuba News, your blog. What do you seek to accomplish by publishing Cuba News, and how can people subscribe to it?
Almost all the media coverage in the United States of Cuba is slanted and negative. The most obvious example was just recently the New York Times. The New York Times printed a big article claiming that Cuban doctors who are working in Venezuela told their patients they won't get care unless they voted for Maduro in the last election. So what I try to do is provide two different things. First of all, I provide translations from the Cuban media into English so people can hear a Cuban point of view. That's the first thing. And the second thing that I provide is I also make my own and have other people help me make translations from the Cuban media on a broad range of issues that even the Cubans themselves don't translate, but that I think are of interest of interest everywhere. There was a, I posted a big piece just yesterday about bullying in Cuban schools, something we never hear, something that we hear about in the United States, but this is a phenomenon in Cuba too. And I provide translations of articles on themes like this, race, gender, sexuality, and so forth, which even the Cubans themselves don't translate, even though they're in the Cuban media. They can only translate so much. Although I know Cuba is a country with many problems, and they're not all the responsibility of Washington, but I do think that what Washington does makes everything for Cuba worse. One thing you should have to keep in mind that we don't talk about much, and that is the Guantanamo base, which the United States operates. Cuba is the only country on the entire planet where an enemy nation, that is, the Helms-Burton Law declares the overthrow of the Cuban government as the official foreign policy of the United States. And Cuba is the only country in the world where a military base operated by a hostile foreign power aimed at overthrowing their government exists. So I'm trying to provide a counterpart, a response to that, and try to provide a broader and more sympathetic and more accurate idea of what's going on in Cuba by bringing material from the Cuban media and translating it into English. It's a Yahoo. I have a personal website, Walter Lippmann, LIPPMANN.com, and the Cuban News Yahoo News Group, which is in its 20th year, almost in its 20th year now, is basically a Yahoo News Group. So if you go to Google and put in Cuba News, one word, Yahoo News Group, you should be able to find it.
Well, Walter, you provide a much-needed service. Michael and I are always delighted to chat with you. We're unfortunately running out of our allotted time, so we're going to have to say goodbye for now, but we hope to have you on again.
Thank you so kindly. I'm at your service. Whenever you need me, call me up.
Walter Lippmann of Cuba News, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.